Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Think Independence Avenue, and if we're honest, a lot of us think prostitutes and crime. Well, a new group of merchants is hoping to radically change that stereotype into something that they regard as more accurate, which is Independence Avenue as the city's new international marketplace. That's later on this morning. First, we'll talk about the tricky ethics of resuscitation and bringing back someone from the brink. Putting it bluntly, there are more tricks available to medical professionals today than ever before, and that raises issues. With us today is Dr. David Kasseret. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and author of Shocked: Adventures in Bringing People Back, Bringing Back the Recently Dead. His latest book is Stoned: A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. And David, so nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, Dr. Kasseret presents the Rosemary Flanagan Lecture this evening at St. Joseph Medical Center. There's a reception at 6. The lecture begins at 7. Free online registration is available at practicalbioethics.org. Well, David, you got into medicine to begin with because you were fascinated by the idea of bringing people back to life. Tell us about that, and then why you later changed your mind about all this.
Sure. So as I tell the story in the book about a girl named Michelle Funk, who was about 2.5 years old when she fell into a creek and drowned outside of Salt Lake City in Utah. And I heard about the story as I was on my way literally to medical school, driving across country, my car loaded with stuff. And the newspaper reports were describing her amazing recovery. She was underwater for an hour. She had no pulse, no heartbeat, no signs of life for a total of 3 hours. And yet she came back from the dead. And that made me want to become an emergency room physician.
But you changed your mind at some point. Then you headed that way and then headed in a different direction.
Yeah, I did. When I got to the clinical years of medical school, I began to see what medicine can do for people and what medicine can do to people. And I took care of several patients very early on in my career who were brought back from the dead, only to spend days, weeks sometimes in an intensive care unit, only to die. And I realized that our technology, our ability to bring people back, was getting way ahead of our ability to make good decisions.
You know, can you tell, doctor, when, a doctor is trying to revive someone, what their chances of full recovery are? Are there indicators along the way or not really?
There are some indicators, but they're really pretty rough, and they're not accurate enough or precise enough or reliable enough to use, for the most part, in a clinical situation.
So it's a crapshoot.
It's a crapshoot, often with a prediction and very wide confidence intervals. So those rescuers who I described picking Michelle Funk out of that clinic and resuscitating her, statistically, they did the wrong thing. I mean, most people would say, even a young kid who's been underwater for an hour, and after 2 or 3 hours, she shouldn't have survived. She certainly shouldn't have survived to have a good function. But she survived. She did well. She went back to school. She actually just got married a couple of years ago.
No kidding.
So, yeah, there are statistical models and their predictions, but often those are wrong.
So bottom line is we don't know why she did so well and so many others flounder.
Well, we have a couple of ideas. You're right. We don't totally know. There's probably a lot of luck or divine intervention or both. She had a couple of factors in her favor, though. She was young. So the younger we are, the more plastic our brains are. So our neurons are still growing and developing. So younger kids do well. The other secret was that she fell into water that was very cold. And we know that
cold matters.
Cold
matters.
That's
one of your central points. Yeah.
Big surprise to me and has been a surprise to researchers over the last 50, 60 years, that the colder, the slower your metabolism is, and the slower your metabolism is, the less oxygen your brain needs. And as that happens, your brain can actually go for longer periods without suffering damage. So a lot of the really great stories of great successes have been for people who have either frozen partially or fallen into very, very cold water.
But still, this sounds like a very sort of murky branch of our understanding and of our science. We lots of unanswered questions here.
That's definitely true. We're understanding a lot more at the molecular level of how to keep cells growing and functioning. Laboratory studies are making advances every day. We haven't gotten good yet, though, at translating some of those laboratory studies into either predictions of how well somebody's going to do or techniques that actually begin to save lives. There have been a lot of advances, but in general, the stuff that's going on in laboratories right now is 10, 15, 20 years ahead of what you see in hospitals and clinics and ambulances.
Well, let's talk about some of those advances, because one of your points I've read in interviews is that doctors these days have more tricks at their disposal than they've ever had before. What are some of those tricks?
Well, one of the tricks, probably the biggest one, is the one that we've already talked about, which is cold.
Cold.
And that's been used for decades, hundreds of years, actually. There's something back in the 1800s known as the Russian method, which sounds kind of ominous, but it consisted of taking accident victims, near-drowning victims, and burying them in snow or ice. That seems kind of crude and potentially kind of cruel, but we've realized that because cold slows the metabolism, that can also be beneficial. And so most people nowadays who have a cardiac arrest, they're out on a tennis court, baseball diamond, shopping mall, their heart stops. Paramedics, when they arrive, will use ice packs and cold saline to try to chill the body temperature. There's research going on now at the University of Pittsburgh that I describe in the book, Shocked, that takes that to the next level. Instead of dropping body temperature by a couple of degrees, they try to get people down to about 50 degrees. Normal body temperature is about 98.6. So you're essentially chilling people down to the temperature of
Wow.
refrigerated potato salad, hoping that you can save some brain function.
Refrigerated potato salad, that's a good analogy there, I guess. Yeah. And that brings us to squirrels and squirrels and their ability to sort of slow their metabolism in winter a little bit. We've learned something from them. Tell us about that.
That's one of the most amazing stories of resuscitation research.
They've been in my garage lately, so don't get me started on squirrels, by the way. Yeah.
Not all squirrels hibernate, though, but there is one species, so-called 13-line squirrels, ground squirrels, that do hibernate. And there have been a lot of researchers interested in squirrel hibernation dating back to the 50s with the idea that, well, one way to slow a patient's metabolism in the setting of a cardiac arrest is to chill them. But animals manage to do this without the benefit of ice or being packed in snow. And so there are a lot of researchers who are trying to figure out what causes hibernation in animals. And one group in particular is very interested in studying hibernation in lemurs, because lemurs are primates, and so biologically they're more similar to us than, say, squirrels are.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is, if you can figure out what makes a lemur hibernate, you might be able to hack the human system to get humans to enter a state of hibernation too, which would offer all sorts of protective benefits to somebody who suffers a cardiac arrest, motor vehicle accident, a soldier injured on the battlefield who needs 8-10 hours of transport.
What other tricks are out there, new things coming down the pike?
Well, you know, one of the biggest new things actually is a fairly old thing, and that's you, that's me, that's all of us, that's crowdsourcing CPR. Whenever I give a talk, I usually ask how many people are certified in basic life support, CPR, and anywhere from half to two-thirds of the people in the room raise their hands. And CPR saves lives. CPR probably saves way more lives now than all of this other crazy technology of advanced cardiac surgery or hypothermia. But just knowing that if you have a cardiac arrest, there's probably somebody close by who knows how to do CPR, that will probably save a lot of lives.
I just heard or read somewhere that the new thinking about CPR is folks shouldn't get caught up in the whole breathing thing into the mouth. If you just focus on the compression aspect of it, your chances of success are pretty good to begin with.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the American Heart Association that puts out CPR guidelines made that shift a couple of years ago.
Okay, okay.
So you're right, for two reasons. One, that if you don't know what you're doing, which is the case of most people performing
yeah.
CPR on a tennis court, if you don't know what you're doing, then mouth-to-mouth resuscitation is actually very difficult and probably doesn't help. The other reason they decided to back off on the mouth-to-mouth piece is that a lot of people, they realized, weren't stepping up to do CPR because they didn't want to do the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation part, which seems silly.
I sort of get it.
Right.
Yeah.
I get it, but you're also letting people die. Often people you know, often family members potentially die because that seems gross. So the combination of those two factors made them realize that they could probably actually save more lives if they just took mouth-to-mouth off the table entirely.
You know, given what you know about resuscitation and all of this science, would you want to be resuscitated if you signed an agreement yourself about how this should be handled, or where are you?
The problem is it really depends. Right now, I'm knock on wood, pretty healthy 47-year-old.
Yeah.
My chances of being resuscitated and having a good function on the other side are pretty good, depending on the setting, somewhere between 20 and 50%. For me, that's probably enough. If I had another medical condition or two or three, certainly if I were older, a poorer prognosis, then that's likely to shift. Again, I'm 47, so ask me again in 5 or 10 years and I might give you a very different answer.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the ethics of resuscitation here. We're visiting with Dr. David Casaret, who's presenting the Rosemary Flanagan Lecture tonight at St. Joseph Medical Center. If you have questions about all of this, the science of it, the ethics of it, 816-235-2888. It's always good to have you call. 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, David, we have this culture, our culture, in which we feel so obligated to always resuscitate, no matter the age, no matter the circumstances. Why is that, and is that changing?
We definitely have that culture, and it might be changing in very, very subtle ways, but with every new advance in what resuscitation can accomplish, that tendency, that sense of obligation to resuscitate just gets stronger. There's actually a court case in California a couple of years ago. You may have seen in bus stations, train stations, health clubs, these automatic external defibrillators, little shock-in-the-box devices that are on walls.
Yes.
You take them down, it reads your heart rhythm, and then gives you a shock if you need to be shocked. There's a family whose mother died in a Target store of a cardiac arrhythmia. There was no external defibrillator handy, and so the family sued Target, saying Target should have provided these external defibrillators. So I'm not weighing on whether they're right or wrong, but we've gotten to the point where it's actually reasonable to sue a department store for not having techniques of resuscitation that 20 or 30 years ago were only available in advanced operating rooms. That's how prevalent this technology has become, and that's what the obligation looks like.
I mean, but do we tend to go overboard in your view?
Well, I'm a hospice and palliative care doc, so I see what happens when we go overboard. I see what happens when somebody has a cardiac arrest in surgery, 84-year-old with an aortic valve replacement, surgery doesn't go well, they resuscitate him, winds up in the ICU for weeks and weeks sometimes. So there are certainly many, many situations in which we go overboard. But there are also success stories. Mm-hmm. Every couple of months, there's an example that's something like that of Michelle Funk, did really well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest problem we have right now is not going overboard or not. It's the fact that we're not talking about these preferences. I think what we really need to be doing as a society is sitting down and talking and asking the kinds of questions like you ask me. So if your heart stops, what do you want? Having those conversations really is the first important step.
And this means filling out those forms, those do not resuscitate forms that are part of our living wills and all those kinds of important papers?
That's part of it. So mm-hmm. I think the important thing to remember, though, is that the do not resuscitate piece, meaning what I want somebody to do if my heart stops, that's really just one very small and very focused part of our overall goals and preferences. And some people don't even think that's an important part. I mean, when I have these conversations with my patients, yeah, we talk about preferences regarding CPR, but really what I want to know from my patients is what's important to them. What does good quality of life look to them? How do we know when their quality of life is not something they'd want to live with? And if they can't make decisions, who should make decisions for them? I mean, those are all the sorts of general questions that we all need to be talking about.
Yeah, I've always struggled with this a little bit because, you know, in practicality, how are these advanced directives implemented? I understand if you're in a hospital and there's at the end of your bed, there's a sheaf of paper, and it says, "Do not resuscitate Dr. David Cassaret." You know, if that be the case. But if you're in the department store, if you're at home, other people are in the house, no one's going to know what David's wishes are. So what happens in practicality?
Sure. It can be messy, honestly.
Yeah.
And I spent some time riding with an ambulance crew when I was researching Schacht and saw what happened when they arrived in an assisted living facility to begin to resuscitate an elderly woman who didn't have, as far as I knew, any sort of advance directive, knew that this wasn't going to go well, but felt obligated to do it mm-hmm. anyway. I will say that one of the most important reasons to fill out those advance directives is not necessarily or not only to give your doctors advice about what to do, but to tell your family members what mm-hmm. they would want. Again, that doesn't protect you necessarily if you collapse on a tennis court, but if you have an event and your family members all know that we sat down with mom over Thanksgiving and she told us very clearly that given her other health problems, she wouldn't want anything aggressive. And we were all there when she said that. That begins to stack the deck in your favor and makes it more likely that people will actually make decisions that you want.
But even knowing that, your impulse, I think, is to respond and try to save, right?
Sure. That's an impulse that is so widespread now. Yeah. Wasn't present 40 or 50 years ago,
yeah.
But I think everybody knows, and television, unfortunately, doesn't help that. If you look at the survival rates of people, one group studied survival after CPR in television,
yeah.
My group studied survival after a coma in soap operas. People do really, really, really well. So all you have to do is turn on the television, and CPR seems simple and obvious, and resuscitation seems very, very effective. And so many family members faced with that circumstance, even if they know that's not what their mother, father, brother would have wanted, it just seems so easy to pick up the phone and call 911.
Resuscitation, that's our topic, the ethics of it, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Sherwood from Kansas City, Missouri. Sherwood, good morning.
Hi. Question
Hi.
For the doctor. It's slightly off the narrative, but I was interested to know if anyone that he had resuscitated or brought back from a death or near-death experience had ever spoken to him about some sort of divine experience after they had died, and if he had heard anything and the like. And I'll take my answer off. I'll listen to it on the radio. Thank you.
Divine experiences when it comes to near-death situations.
Yes, that's a great question. These are certainly experiences that I've heard a lot about. As a hospice and palliative care doctor, I take care of many people who have been brought back and haven't done well. And so maybe because of that, many of the experiences I hear about, I wouldn't call them divine experiences necessarily, only because that's not necessarily how my patients describe them always. But many of the experiences I hear about are not anything you'd want to call divine. They really are bad experiences,
mm-hmm.
Often tied in with their experiences in an intensive care unit, being paralyzed or unable to move, being short of breath. I think for every divine experience I hear about of resuscitation, I also hear about something that seems almost post-traumatic in a way. So I hear both.
I'm wondering about the arc of medical research and sort of where we're heading here, David. I mean, can you anticipate that 20 years or 40 years down the road that the sort of the parameters surrounding when you do resuscitate and when you don't will be clearer to people, and paramedics will know when to weigh in, when the chances of saving someone are better than not?
You know, the optimist in me says, yes, I would love to see that, and maybe we will, and certainly we'll have better data to guide us, and potentially even laboratory tests that could be conducted in the field to give us a sense of what's going on. So I think that's reasonable. On the other hand, though, I think as resuscitation gets more and more effective, it's entirely possible that people will actually pay less attention to the data. So if you have some evidence that somebody has a slightly poorer chance than other people of being resuscitated, but that poor chance, quote unquote, is only a 70 or 80% chance,
yeah,
most people would take it anyway.
Yeah.
And so as technology gets better, I think it's easy to imagine that we'll just all decide we want to be resuscitated with then the option of figuring things out later.
But you would encourage people to consider what kinds of factors when they make a resuscitation decision. I'm sure we're talking about if there are advanced directives of some kind, the age of the person involved. What else?
So certainly the circumstances. Somebody with multiple medical conditions is likely to do much worse than a young kid who's otherwise healthy.
Yeah.
People who are living in nursing homes tend to do worse, at least in part because people living in nursing homes have often other medical conditions.
Yeah, yeah. And anything else you'd point to that people should think about?
There are certainly other factors that are important, but we don't always know. So the simplest... No resuscitation is simple, but the simplest resuscitation is somebody who is generally pretty healthy, who has a heart rhythm problem. And I spent some time talking in Shocked about how the heart works, how reliable it is, just in the time that's taken me to say that sentence. Both of our hearts hopefully have been through 10 or 12 cycles, but it doesn't really take much to flip that cycle off. So when that happens, everything else is more or less okay. It's just a heart rhythm problem. Those people do really, really well.
We just have a minute left, but I was really struck by some of your comments you've made about the early art of resuscitation and how that's changed over the years. What did we used to do to try to save people? just sort of in a knee-jerk kind of way.
Pretty much everything you can think of, from throwing people over the back of a horse,
which I love that one.
I tried.
I love that one.
Yeah. Probably not my finest moment to
burying
people.
You did it yourself?
I did. In researching the book, I paid a horse trader to throw me over the back of a horse just to see what it would be like. And it is entirely as unpleasant as it sounds.
You're getting bounced up and down. People used to do that. Why? What was the thinking?
Not really sure there was a lot of thinking, but to be charitable, maybe it replicated some of the chest wall movements of breathing. There was tickling the back of somebody's throat with a feather. All sorts of other techniques were used.
Maybe some we can't even mention on the radio very easily.
Indeed.
Yeah, right. Well, Dr. David Kasserit is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He's the author of Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. And again, he speaks this evening at 6. There's a pre-reception get-together, then a pre-lecture get-together. The lecture begins at 7. That's at St. Joseph Medical Center. More information, practicalbioethics.org. David, thanks so much for your time.
Oh,
really enjoyed
you.
Having you.
This has been great.
You
thanks.
Bet.